Hello and welcome to our latest AIS Politics on Point podcast. Today's episode is part of our special series on transatlantic talks. My name is Michael Sinkenau. I'm the director of the AIS, the Austrian Institute for European and Security Policy. This special series is hosted by the AIS and supported by the Young Transatlantic Initiative here in Austria, but also by the US Embassy in Vienna. And today we are talking about foreign information manipulation, especially focusing on the phenomenon of disinformation, how foreign interference is manifesting in the US and in the EU, and how to counter foreign interference and disinformation. Our guest today is a leading expert on disinformation and on researching foreign interference, Brett Schaefer, senior fellow and head of the information manipulation team at the Alliance for Securing Democracy at the German Marshall Fund in Washington. Thank you very much, Brett, for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We'd like to talk about disinformation and foreign interference in a very general way, to also draw experience from the US. Maybe we can also dive into what initiatives the European Union has taken recently. But first of all, I would like to start with the basics, with how we can identify this phenomenon of disinformation and what your take is on the definition of foreign interference. How does it manifest itself?
Yeah, I mean, disinformation has a very clear definition that's been around for at least 100 years. And I think the clear defining point that separates disinformation from misinformation is intent. There is an intent to mislead with disinformation. There's also an intent to create some sort of change. So either you want to change somebody's opinion, you want to create some sort of reaction, but disinformation is not just somebody who's wrong. It's not false information. There is a clear intent by the actor to mislead for a specific purpose. So within the context of FIMI, so foreign information manipulation and interference, disinformation is part of it, but it's not it in its entirety. There can be FIMI activity that does not necessarily involve disinformation, because you can have covert operations where you have foreign actors pretending to be domestic actors, for example. There's many sort of different elements of FIMI that aren't necessarily, that don't necessarily dovetail with disinformation, although disinformation is a significant part of it. So when we look at foreign information manipulation, which is the term we kind of prefer to use because it is broader than just disinformation, because it involves a bunch of behavioral things, how we define it, which is largely how the FBI defines it in the US, is it needs to be subversive, coercive, criminal, or covert. It doesn't need to be all of those things, but it needs to include some of those things. And the covert is, I think, a critical part of it. There's a lot of things foreign actors can do to try to influence public opinion that are completely acceptable in the realm of diplomacy. I mean, that is public diplomacy. Nations have public diplomacy units because they want to influence other countries in a way that benefits their own country. That all has to be overt and clear and transparent. So when it happens covertly, when you have a foreign actor presenting themselves as something they're not in an effort to try to create a sort of beneficial policy change for that country in a more covert manner, that's when you get into foreign interference. And so those are the I think, clear distinction points, that disinformation is not misinformation. There are differences there. And foreign information manipulation and interference is different from public diplomacy and different from efforts to influence foreign publics.
In an interconnected world that we live in today, where digitalization and social media plays a very decisive role, of course, on social media, on online platforms, these forms of disinformation are flourishing and are growing, especially in the more recent past. Although the whole phenomenon is not entirely new in its essence. Yeah? We have had means of propaganda, means of influence, means of sabotage also in ancient past. However, of course, especially since COVID-19, but also the most recent elections, both in the US and in the EU, the term of disinformation, the relevance, the aggression that is taking place is increasing. So how would you now, just drawing on the recent past, identify the most important trends, the most important shifts that have been taking place, also with regards to the most recent US election this November?
Yeah, the digital information environment has created sort of the perfect storm for both domestic and foreign disinformation campaigns, but especially for the foreign, because the challenge that foreign actors used to have in their efforts to try to manipulate public opinion in other countries is it was quite expensive, and you had to have people on the ground, you had to really understand the target audience, you had to speak the language perfectly. And so all of these things took significant resources. I mean, certainly the KGB had those resources, and we know the Russians have done this obviously for decades now. But now you've seen a democratization of the disinformation landscape. You don't need to have significant resources to be able to pull off a successful interference campaign, because social media has made it so much easier. It's made it easier, one, to be anonymous, to pretend to be something you're not, to spread unverified information, to manufacture consensus, and to study the target audience. And I think that's key when you look at how effective certain nations are at finding the pressure points in democracies. So let's take the Russia trying to target the US example. The US has a lot of division, a lot of divisive sort of points that are pretty easy to pick out if you're studying the US context. But that used to be, again, quite difficult if you were sitting in Moscow. Now all they need is an internet connection and to log onto Twitter. And in real time, they can get a sense of what are Americans talking about? What do they care about? What is a good topic for us to exploit to try to sow division or to try to at least be involved in the conversation in a way that we can shift it in some way? So I think that you can't sort of understate how significant the digital information revolution has been. But tactically, what we've seen a shift from, let's say, 2016, where everyone in the US first became aware of the possibility of foreign interference being a thing, to now is what foreign actors have also realized is it is beneficial for them to blend the foreign with the domestic. Because if it is purely foreign, if it isn't somebody sitting in St. Petersburg at the Internet Research Agency pretending to be an American, that's pretty easy for the companies, the tech platforms to take down, for government to try to take action against. What becomes difficult is when they try to get information laundered through mm-hmm. Americans. And then that ties everybody in knots, because now it is not clearly foreign. There's a domestic element, so there's a free speech element, and there's a censorship element. And we saw both Iran and Russia this election cycle really try to exploit that vulnerability.
Do you think that this new dimension of merging foreign and domestic elements of disinformation, where domestic actors are voluntarily also picking up on foreign narratives, do you see this phenomenon that also manifesting in the European context, that it could also spill over, sort to say, from the most recent developments in the US and manifest in the EU?
Sure. And I mean, you've always had what you might call fellow travelers, what the Russians have called useful idiots. There have always been people domestically who, on their own accord, have adopted narratives from foreign state and presented them as their own and do it without any financial support or otherwise from these foreign actors. So that's always existed. I think the difference now is you've seen more of a strategic effort from foreign actors to find those individuals and to get information in those individuals' hands, because they realize it's tougher to take down and censor. So take the EU context. Russia's big problem trying to message to the EU right now is their state media outlets, at least RT and Sputnik, are banned. So they can't just publish things through overt state media outlets. There's a lot of different groups looking out for fake accounts, for clearly fraudulent behavior on the side of foreign actors. And so I think you'll definitely see a greater effort to try to blend beneficial, and I mean beneficial for foreign actors, into domestic outlets through domestic individuals where then it becomes this free speech versus censorship debate. And when that debate happens, it's a win-win for the foreign actor, because one of two things happens. One, they can spread the message and they're not going to be restricted, so that's good for them. Or two, there is an effort to censor or shut down that individual or outlet, and then that creates a censorship debate. So unfortunately, the conditions are such that there is really a sort of beneficial playing field for foreign actors if they can find, witting or unwitting, domestic actors to be involved in their information campaigns.
From the analysis that we have also conducted at the AIS in the Austrian and the European context, we have identified that understanding the issue and studying these new mechanisms, these new tactics of disinformation, is maybe the most crucial step to also counteracting disinformation, to have a clearer picture on what it is and how disinformation is manifesting itself, how also the trend is changing. Can you tell us a little bit about the platforms, the dashboards that you and your team have created to actually facilitate that analysis and that identification of disinformation?
Yeah, I mean, our strategy is to shine sunlight on what we're seeing online. So both from a narrative level, to let people know of what the narratives are that Russia, China, Iran are attempting to spread, but also the tactics and techniques. And I think that's critical too, is there's a media literacy component of this, but there's also this digital literacy component of it. People need to understand how information systems work to know how they can be exploited. It's basically like instructing people about scams and scammers and spammers and the tactics they use to try to get money from people is often what disinformers use as well. So there's an education component to this. So some of the dashboards we've created, like our Hamilton 2.0 dashboard, it allows concerned citizens, but largely journalists, other academics, researchers, to have a repository of everything that's coming out of Russian, Chinese, and Iranian government officials and state media outlets, so that people can go and do their own research. They can see if these are narratives that are being amplified by known state-backed actors. So it's not the solution in and of itself, for sure, but we hope it's a piece of the puzzle that allows journalists to tell a more compelling story when they're trying to let Americans know about what these foreign adversaries are doing. We also have a tool called the Information Laundromat, which the concept there is, especially within the EU, where Russian state media is banned, where else are these narratives appearing online? In places where the attribution is not clear because they're not being posted to a state media website. And so that helps illuminate the fact that oftentimes when people come in contact with foreign propaganda, they're not coming in contact with it through channels that make it clear that they're watching or reading foreign propaganda. They appear to be domestic local news outlets. They appear to be at times men's interest sites, spirituality sites. So there's all these different vectors that we see propaganda, disinformation reaching audiences in ways that are not transparent to the audience who the producer of that content is.
Maybe towards the end, it would also be interesting to talk a little bit about countermeasures and the current sanction regimes that we see in the EU. You've mentioned it already with Russian state media outlets that have been banned successfully, probably mentioning also new strategic approaches by the European Union, such as the Digital Services Act, vis-a-vis the initiatives on a state level and a policy level that you observe in the US. What can we learn from each other to make each other's policies and strategies to countering disinformation and foreign influence more effective? And what role does international cooperation also play in that sense?
Well, international cooperation, I think, is critical from an information sharing perspective. Like, whatever happens in Europe makes its way to the US and vice versa. And so you have to be aware of the tactics and trends happening globally, because they get recycled. And they might manifest in slightly different ways depending on the context. But to give you an example, in the U.S. election, we had a bunch of bomb threats targeting voting centers and polling places. We had an idea that was coming because it happened 5 days earlier in Moldova. And so you always want to sort of look around the world at what bad actors are doing to try to manipulate the information environment or target elections, because there are lessons to learn there. There are some differences, I think, in the EU approach and the US approach, largely around differences in terms of how we sort of interpret free speech. So the US, with the First Amendment, with this idea that government should not be involved in restricting speech, is very hesitant to ban things, very hesitant to take down accounts, to do anything that would smell of censorship. The EU is a little bit more comfortable with it just because of a different sort of free speech tradition where there's this idea of protecting the speech of others, which is not something that is inherent in the sort of American free speech context. That said, while there are certainly some slight divergences, and we've seen from the political right in the US actually some real opposition to the Digital Services Act, I think there's a lot more commonalities there, especially if you're focused on behavior and if you're focused on the criminality of some of this behavior. So what would be sort of illegal or illicit behavior across the EU is largely going to be illegal in the US as well. And so if you're focused a little bit less on the content and whether or not something is true or false, but the manipulative behavior, I think there's probably very little divergence in the EU and US approach. I mean, no one, I think, would deem it to be acceptable for a foreign actor to present themselves as a citizen of a country using the anonymity of the internet to try to manipulate conversations or mislead audiences. So I think by focusing in at the behavioral level, understanding the tactics and techniques, there's a lot of common ground. Where there's going to be a little bit of differences is, one, the US is unlikely to focus on the platforms. The EU has obviously made the platforms a huge focus of their efforts, effectively saying the platforms are responsible for what happens there, and if they are not effectively moderating their platforms, the EU is going to drop the hammer on them. The US is unlikely to take that approach, especially over the next 4 years in the relationship between Elon Musk and Donald Trump. That is exceptionally unlikely that we'll see that. And so the US focus has been more on creating criminal cases through the DOJ, sanctioning individuals, sanctioning outlets, and using that as they hope, a deterrent for bad actors to try to engage in future manipulation activities. But again, I think despite the differences, there are more commonalities between the two approaches and the more that we can learn from each other.
We've talked about the fact that disinformation is targeting democratic societies, is targeting the trust of societies, the cohesion, and ultimately also the social stability and security of states. However, it is individuals and people who are the ones that are consuming this disinformation who are also targeted directly by foreign interference. So the very last question is the very last remark from your side. What would your main message be to the individuals listening us to that podcast today on how to better identify, how to better prepare, how to better equip oneself on an individual basis against foreign interference, against disinformation?
Yeah, the fight against disinformation and foreign malign influence can't be just a top-down approach. The government clearly has a role. There are things government can do that individuals cannot. And there's information that governments have that individuals wouldn't have. I mean, if there is a sophisticated covert campaign, we can't expect individuals to necessarily be able to ferret out illicit money flowing into an outlet. That's not something that an individual can do. So there's a role for government. But most of the responsibility, I do think, falls on individuals, because disinformation only has an effect when real people adopt those narratives and spread it among their own communities, whether you're spreading it online or offline. I mean, this has been the case for generations. People trust information that's coming from trusted sources. Trusted sources tends to be your friends and family. And so if people are not taking the time to verify information if they are spreading information that is unverified because it aligns with their political or social points of view. And even when it turns out clearly to be false, we see sometimes people say, well, you know, that may not have been true. But, you know, the broader concept is still relevant. We have to see people be more responsible at both their information consumer habits, the websites they're going to, how they're engaging with social media. But in particular, everybody now is a producer of information at some level. Even if you're retweeting things or liking them, you're lending some credibility to it. You're giving visibility to people, to that article or that video, to people in your community. And so people have to take on that responsibility of not being part of the problem.
Brett, I would like to thank you very much for your very interesting remarks, for also your clear statements, what states, but also individuals can do better to contribute to countering disinformation, to countering foreign malign influence. And I'd like to also bring this podcast to an end by thanking again our team at the AIS. This is the last special series on the transatlantic talks. However, we would also appreciate if you stay tuned for our other podcast episodes that we at the AIS are publishing in our Politics on Point podcast series. Special thanks again to the Transatlantic Initiative, who have supported this podcast series, and the U.S. Embassy in Vienna. Thanks again to you, Brett, and looking forward to continuing our conversation.
Thank you.